Coming up on this week's book show, Malcolm Gladwell's best-selling books include The Tipping Point, Blink, and Outliers. In his first book in 6 years, Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know, Gladwell offers an examination of our interactions with strangers and why they often go so terribly wrong. Malcolm Gladwell on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Malcolm Gladwell's books have become cultural touchstones. The Tipping Point, Blink, and Outliers, just to name a few, have revealed surprising new concepts about nature and psychology, often changing the way we think. In his first book in 6 years, Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know, Gladwell offers an examination of our interactions with strangers and why they often go so terribly wrong. In Probing the Deceptions of Bernie Madoff, The Trial of Amanda Knox, The Suicide of Sylvia Plath, The Jerry Sandusky Pedophilia Scandal at Penn State, and The Death of Sandra Bland, he throws into doubt our conception of these and other stories we thought we knew so well. Malcolm Gladwell is a staff writer at The New Yorker and hosts the podcast Revisionist History. His latest book is Talking to Strangers, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Malcolm Gladwell back to the book show. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure.
Yes, I'm happy to be here.
I mentioned a long list of things that you are probing in this book, cases that are very well known that we know. Maybe we knew better then than we do now in some cases, but really, at the heart of it is the Sandra Bland case, and I'm curious as to what it was about that case that went on your radar to say, oh, there's something we can explore here.
Yeah. Well, remember there was that long string of police shootings that we were suddenly very focused on as a country, starting in 2014 with Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown. And the Sandra Bland case was in the middle of that, and it was, I don't know, to be perfectly honest, why it drew me, it sort of affected me as much as it did. Maybe it's because it's just so sort of stupidly, tragically absurd. It's not late at night. There's no sort of ambiguity. It's just a young professional woman coming from a job interview in the middle of the day in a sleepy little Texas town. I mean, it's like she's pulled over for no reason. She starts a conversation with a police officer, and we have the other thing that's particular about that case is we have the whole conversation. So, you know, with Michael Brown in Ferguson, we're still arguing about what happened between the police officer, Darren Wilson, and Michael Brown before Brown's death. There is no argument about Sandra Bland. We have the whole thing is captured on the officer's dash cam video. So you can sort of see, you know, and you can listen to the conversation go off the rails, the encounter go off the rails. And maybe that's what that allowed me and others, and many, many others who've watched that video, to kind of really immerse themselves in the tragedy of it.
And you say when you get down to it, it is in watching that dash cam video, it's a police officer who is incapable of understanding the person he was arresting.
Yes. But more than that, I think crucially, it is a police officer who was deliberately put in the position where he was forced to make a judgment about someone that he could not make. So it's not just that there was something deficient about the police officer. In fact, he was doing what he was trained to do. So the issue is structural, not personal. And that's a big issue with this book, is that I came to the conclusion that when we analyze these kinds of tragedies, too often what we do is we personalize them and we say, oh, this is about a bad cop, a racist cop, a violent cop. Or we look at the victim and we say, this is about a victim who didn't understand X or Y. I think that way of making sense of these cases is self-defeating. It doesn't lead anywhere. You know, this kind of thing's been going on for centuries in America, and we haven't made any progress in stopping them. And the reason is we refuse to see the larger structural context in which these events happen. And this book is about trying to place that encounter between those two people in a much broader context.
You certainly have written about race extensively, and yet it does not play a major part in this book, because you are trying to show those differences. You do not make as much of a case of the officer being white and Sandra Bland being black as you do about the training. And you also, in the final chapter of the book, give us an idea of what this particular officer's day was like a year prior, or just a random day, mm-hmm. that this was a guy who pretty much pulled everybody over.
Yeah, in fact, he's asked in the deposition, point blank, did you pull her over because she's black? And he says, I pull everyone over. And, if you look at his record, we have the record of every police stop he made in his career as a police officer, and he's not lying. The man pulled so many people over for totally trivial reasons. Sandra Bland is not some anomaly. He, Brian Insignia, the name of the officer in question, was, he was the kind of paradigmatic, modern, proactive police officer. He is doing exactly what we train cops to do these days, which is he was on high alert. And if you had even the slightest traffic infraction, if he was pulling people over for the light above their license plate was out. Like these kinds of things that are in the, a police officer is permitted under the traffic codes to pull you over for that, but it's like ticky-tacky stuff. And he did that because he was always searching for some more serious evidence of criminal activity. But I think race is a factor? Absolutely. But I just didn't think it was productive to focus on that in the way that we usually, I think, racialize these encounters.
You talk in the book about truth default theory. What is that, and why is that so important in discussing our interaction with strangers?
So this is an idea from a very brilliant psychologist named Tim Levine at the University of Alabama. And Levine was trying to figure out something that's puzzled psychologists for years, which is, why are human beings so bad at telling when they're being lied to? Because we're terrible. And this has been verified and studied a million different ways. Basically, when you're confronted with someone who's lying to you, you have a slightly better than chance, like 54% accuracy rate in figuring out whether they're lying or not. That's really, really bad. And psychologists have struggled for years to figure out, well, why are we so bad at this? You'd think we'd be good at it. You'd think human beings would have been selected during evolution for their ability to detect deception. Levine's answer is that the opposite is true. We are, in fact, selected through evolution for our ability to implicitly trust others. Because when you assume, if you're someone who basically trusts what you're told and implicitly assumes that the person you are communicating with is not being deceitful, that gives you an enormous advantage. It's what allows you to communicate efficiently. It allows you to get on with your day. It allows you to start organizations. It allows you to hire people and let them do their jobs. There's a million things. If you think about it, our whole society is premised on the notion that people are who they say they are, right? And so his argument is, that's the way we're programmed as human beings. And that means that we will occasionally be deceived, and there's not much we can do about it. And Levine wants us to accept that trade-off because he thinks it's a good trade-off. And that's something that plays a huge role in this book, because I agree with Levine. This is a necessary trade-off. As human beings, we don't want to turn into paranoid, suspicious creatures, right? But that if we're going to be trusting, we have to acknowledge the fact that we will occasionally, inevitably, be deceived. And we have to learn to cope with that and live with that.
And both people in the Sandra Bland case, they didn't trust each other.
Yes, exactly.
There was concern on both sides.
Yeah, although it is more problematic on the part of the police officer because he has all the power.
Right.
So she has been pulled over on the most flimsy of pretexts, and a man with a gun and a badge has come up to her, and on the basis of this absurd pretext, he has inserted himself into her day and, you know, forced her to stop and submit to authority. It's on him, I think, to establish the terms of their encounter. That he does not do. Instead, what he does is he assumes she's a bad person, which is absurd. I mean, she didn't use her turning signal, right? It's just like the whole thing, you can't make this up. This is America in 2017.
And I kept on thinking about the case after reading the book that this would not have come to her attention had she not taken her own life in her cell 3 days later.
Yeah.
That's probably true, right?
You know, it's funny. I never thought of that before, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Like, this happens. The thing you have to remember is this exact scenario happens thousands of times, you know, every week on the roadways of America. And most of those we never hear about. People are pulled over for no reason, submitted to these kinds of outrageous impositions by police officers, and left feeling alienated and isolated from the rest of society or from law enforcement. And we just kind of shrug it off. The only reason this particular one rises to the level of me writing a book about it is, you're right, she takes her life in her cell. I mean, it is kind of, that's a very sort of sobering observation.
You have a chapter in the book on the Stanford rape case, and mm-hmm. you look at the sexual assault at Stanford with this young man by the name of Brock Turner. And you look at it through the lens of alcohol. And mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating because it is alcohol alters our perception. So
yeah.
It is a difference between being drunk and sober, but also putting it into your greater conversation about this idea of two strangers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's funny, that chapter. It's the most, to my mind, common sense chapter in the book, and yet as people read it, it seems like it might become the most controversial chapter in the book. Sort of a strange how people see things. But, you know, it's a... When I was very interested, because I was interested in this question of what happens when strangers communicate and what are the reasons why their communication may go awry. So I naturally thought about campus sexual assaults, which not always, but often begin with conversation. They're two young people, and in the beginning, their encounter is benign. They meet at a party, they have an interaction, they may know each other, they may not know each other, but it's a normal part of the lives of a young college student. And then something happens in the course of that interaction to make it badly go wrong. And in many cases, a crime is committed, you know, a sexual assault occurs. And there are, let's just be clear, tens of thousands of sexual assaults on campuses every year. I mean, it's an astonishingly high number. When I started getting interested in this, I went around the country and started talking to people who study sexual assaults on campus. And the first thing they said to me was, well, you know, you can't talk about this without talking about alcohol. I was like, oh, I hadn't realized that. And they're like, yeah, I mean, this is not exclusively about alcohol, but an astonishingly high number of these encounters that go so badly awry involve one or both parties, usually both parties, being very, very drunk. And that's not an irrelevant consideration. Why? Because when you are inebriated, and we're not talking about tipsy. We're talking about, I mean, in the case that I chose to profile is quite typical in the sense that both parties were one party, both, it may be the case that both parties were blackout drunk. So they had drunk so much so quickly that their hippocampus had shut down and they were no longer capable of forming memories. That is, you know, one of the most extreme forms of drunkenness. They were wasted. And many, many, many of these cases involve people who are very, 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 very inebriated. And when you're in that state, it isn't just that your ability to communicate is obviously massively impaired. It's that you are no longer, in some crucial way, yourself. You have lost control of yourself. And that is what I was trying to get at in that, that people, particularly college students, seem unaware of the fact that if you drink to excess, you can turn yourself into an unrecognizable person who is capable of committing a criminal act. You may not have a trace of criminal in you sober, but drunk, you can rape somebody, right? And that notion, and on the other side, that you can be someone who is ordinarily in control of your life and destiny, but drunk, you radically increase your chances of being victimized, right? That idea of how much alcohol transforms you and leads you into positions that you would never have conceived is something that, I mean, to adults seems who have had experience with this seems commonsensical. To young people, it is surprisingly a kind of radical thought. I look at in the book at surveys, public opinion surveys, and you just contrast the way that people over the age of 40 and people of college age think about alcohol's role in sexual assault, and adults think it plays a huge role. And kids are largely indifferent to what alcohol can do. I find that like kind of weird and quite distressing.
The name of the new book is Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. You say that it's strange, and you seem to come at this a couple of times. For example, in writing about the Amanda Knox case, that so often we're focusing on, is she guilty? That's the question. Is she guilty? And you look at it more as, okay, why were so many people convinced that she was guilty?
Yeah. I mean, Amanda Knox, in retrospect, you go back and look at that case, it is bizarre that so many people were convinced she was guilty. She's like, so clearly not guilty. Like, if there's ever a kind of transparent case of a miscarriage of justice, it is this. There's no physical evidence linking her to the crime. On the contrary, the guy who clearly committed the crime, his DNA is everywhere, his blood's everywhere. I mean, it's like, she's just this kind of, you know, the Italian police and the English tabloids would have us believe that a 19-year-old, you know, awkward, immature teenager from Seattle is within 3 weeks of arriving at Italy, you know, engaging in murderous sex games with total strangers in her apartment. Like, what? Like, this is just bananas. So the question is, why did we go through this strange period where so many people were convinced she was complicit in this crime, if not the actual instigator of it? And the answer is, and this gets into a big theme of the book, is that what I talk about, this notion of transparency, that one of the ways we misread strangers is that we come to strangers with the assumption that their external, their demeanor and their facial expressions are a reliable indicator of their internal emotional states. And that is not true, that you cannot look at the way someone behaves and make accurate inferences about the way they're feeling. And particularly because some portion of people don't match. When they're angry, they don't look angry. When they're happy, they don't look happy. When they're remorseful, they don't look remorseful. And Amanda Knox is one of those people. She just doesn't, she did not behave in the way that, you know, people in Italy expected a grieving roommate to behave. That does not make her guilty of killing her roommate. That just means she's different, right? And, you know, it's astonishing how much weight we place on this totally flawed way of making sense of another person.
You write in the book, in that transparency chapter, the transparency problem ends up in the same place as the default to truth problem. Our strategies for dealing with strangers are deeply flawed, but they are also socially necessary. Mm-hmm. We need the criminal justice system and the hiring process and the selection of babysitters to be human, but the requirement of humanity means that we have to tolerate an enormous amount of error. Yeah. Has our level of tolerance changed?
I think so. I think we're in a punitive moment. So I have a whole chapter on the Jerry Sandusky case at Penn State.
Mm.
And my concern, the reason I wanted to write that chapter is not out of, it's not because of Jerry Sandusky. What happened to him, I think, was, you know, just and fair and greatly overdue. My concern was that having convicted Jerry Sandusky, the prosecutors in the case then took an additional step and went after the leadership of Penn State. And their case against the leadership of Penn State is absurd. I mean, if you actually go through the case materials, as I have, and read about what they were claiming, it's ridiculous. They're basically saying that the president of a university is responsible for peering into the heart and understanding whatever darkness lies within every one of his or her employees. That's crazy. Right? Like, particularly when you understand the extent to which it is difficult for us to make strangers and to make sense of strangers, and doubly difficult for us to make sense of strangers who are pedophiles, whose entire life's work is about concealing their dark desires from the rest of the world. And then you're really going to turn around and jail executives at a, you know, top officials at a university because they failed to see something that nobody else saw either? I mean, it's crazy. You have pedophiles who are, like the Larry Nassar case in Michigan State. These guys are around for years committing their crime. There are parents, in the Larry Nassar case, there were parents who were in the room while Nassar was molesting their daughters, and they didn't see it, right? Or they saw it and they didn't understand what they were seeing, or they denied it, or whatever. That is not because they are terrible, neglectful parents who were endorsing the molestation of their children. No, it's because they're human beings, and it's really hard for human beings to understand what a stranger is up to, particularly when a stranger is up to something that dark and perverse, right? No one is going around saying the parents who were in those rooms with Larry Nassar belong in jail for negligence, right? No one says that. So then why would we say that the president of Penn State belongs in jail? That's the position the prosecution is taking. And I cannot, this literally, you can tell from my tone of voice, this drives me crazy. But I think that we have got the stage in this as a society where, you know, we're not content just to go after the bad guy. We want to pull down the whole temple, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. We have to accept the fact that as human beings, we have blind spots, not because we are evil or neglectful or incompetent, but because we're human, right?
So the thing that I guess the question I have is about neglectful. If someone, as was reported in the Sandusky case, and you do write about this, and you make the case that this case was a mess, and it certainly seems that way in many ways beyond the jailing of Jerry Sandusky. But if you have people who are coming to the school and saying they have grave concerns about this man, and little or nothing is done, is that not negligent?
I feel much more comfortable saying that there was real negligence in the case of Larry Nassar at Michigan State, because there you had, from the get-go, you had his victims were going to their parents and saying, this guy's doing weird things to me. You had, on I think there are 14 different occasions when officials of Michigan State were informed of really troubling allegations against Larry Nassar, and nothing was done. There, I think you can make a strong case, that there was real negligence on the part of the leadership of that institution. But Sandusky's very different. You simply never had that. The president of Penn State was never told that, you know, Jerry Sandusky was raping young boys in the showers of the athletic center. I mean, that was a fantasy that was created by the prosecution. What he was told is that Jerry Sandusky was, quote unquote, horsing around with kids in the shower. That's a very different statement. And at the time the president was told that, he was like, he didn't know what to make of it, as none of us would. Well, so they're like snapping towels at each other. You know, it's like, it was a difficult, it's a very, so these cases are not all the same. And that's why I chose that Sandusky case very deliberately. And I talk about Nassar in that same chapter and make a real distinction between the two. I think it's important to understand that there are times when the evidence is pretty unequivocal, where you are neglectful as a person in a position of responsibility if you don't act. And there are other cases where it's unfair to ask that people in positions of authority be able to discern the dark truth in some stranger's heart. So I think we just need to be a little smarter about which cases are problematic and which are simply evidence of people being, of humans being human.
In circling back and wrapping up our conversation, I guess I'm interested not just within the in the case of Sandra Bland, but just in general. Mm-hmm. Are we as a culture, especially at a time when we're all so polarized, mm-hmm. are we always, do you think, going to blame the stranger?
Well, that is the easiest thing to do under these circumstances, is to kind of, when we misunderstand someone, to lash out at them as opposed to ask ourselves, maybe it was our fault. Maybe we're bad at listening. Maybe we lack empathy. I think about this I'm always struck on Twitter, you know, when people then get into big fights on Twitter, how often those fights are misunderstandings and not legitimate disagreements. You know, that I sometimes read these exchanges between people, and I think you guys aren't actually disagreeing. You just don't understand the particular nuance here, right? The person hasn't explained himself properly, and you're not listening, and you're jumping to a conclusion based on 142 characters, right? So, like, I do think that we need to be, particularly these days when it seems like attention is being meted out in very, very small doses, that the capacity for error in the judgments we draw about others is large, and we just need to be a little more on guard against those kinds of mistakes.
I have to say, I read this book when it first came out in Galley and knew I wanted to talk to you. And then more recently, just to familiarize myself with it, I listened to the audiobook, which is just a really cool podcast because you have all of the voices and all of mm-hmm. the tape, mm-hmm. and it's so beautifully produced. And I just wanted to note that for people if they want to hear more about this, to hear your voice tell the story and to hear all of the other yeah. voices is really compelling.
I think I actually think it's a better book in the podcast, in the audio form, than it is in the print form.
It's really something.
Thank you.
The name of the book is Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. It is published by Little Brown. Malcolm Gladwell, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.